Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show. Today I'm going to tell you the story of a mariner's dream that predicted his shipmates' deaths in spooky detail. The first mate of the bark Mimi saw seaweed covering all but three of his shipmates, and the next day, all but three of them drowned in one of Oregon's worst ever salvage disasters. This story was first published on July 17, 2011. Here we go. Sailors are known as a superstitious bunch, which makes a certain amount of sense. After all, their business is one in which life and death are determined by sublime and inscrutable forces, and you never know when your number will come up. Sure, being careful to always step aboard with the right foot first probably won't help, but it's not going to hurt either, is it? And why take a chance? Still, surely sailors' superstitions don't have any basis in the real world. It's not logical. But every now and then, a story comes along that has to make you wonder. One such story is the disaster that befell the German bark Mimi on the coast of Oregon in 1913. And the nightmare its first mate had on the night before. Now, the Mimi was an iron-hulled sailing ship homeported in Hamburg. It was a four-masted, 283-foot, 1,984-ton behemoth built in 1893. Under the direction of Captain Ludwig Westphal, it wandered in the fog onto a sandy beach at the mouth of the Nehalem River on February 13, 1913. And there it sat, parked on the beach like a stuck pickup truck, on a perfectly even keel, a model of Prussian orderliness even in shipwreck. At low tide, the crew could actually walk ashore. Such an easy grounding, of course, presented a tricky question. Could the ship be coaxed back into the water, refloated, and sent on its way? Well, Captain Charles Fisher, of salvage firm Fisher Engineering, figured he knew just how this could be done. So he essentially bought the ship from the insurance company and set his plan into action. By the way, Captain Charles Fisher wasn't really a captain. He just called himself one. Kind of like how Woodrow Wilson's advisor, Colonel House, called himself Colonel, but wasn't really a colonel. Back to our story. The salvage firm's plan sowed the seeds of disaster. They started taking ballast off the ship. 1,200 tons of rocks were trundled out of the ship and hauled away. The idea was to make the ship lighter. Once it was off the beach, the ballast could be put back in. The trouble was the ballast was there for a reason, to keep the ship from capsizing. This wasn't just the regular ballast that's loaded in a ship when it's empty. This was the permanent ballast. The ballast the naval architect who designed the ship specified must remain in the hull at all times. Four-masted sailing ships pack a lot of weight upstairs, and their centers of gravity have got to be paid attention to. And it was this fact that was most on the mind of Garibaldi Life Station keeper Robert Farley. As the job went on, Farley made several attempts to warn Westphal and the salvage crew of the risk they were taking, but he was ignored. Crews were racing to get everything ready for the big day, the spring tide on April 6th, when the water would be higher than any other time of year, and they'd have their best chance to winch the big vessel free of the sand. Unfortunately, when spring tide arrived, so did a gale warning. A big one was coming in. The ship would have to be floated quickly before it arrived. This news must have caused something akin to panic in Farley. The salvage workers were pulling the ship off the beach sideways, so the incoming breakers would be striking it broadside. Farley was afraid the storm-driven seas would flip the dangerously lightened ship, and he would then be forced to risk his life-saving crew rowing out to rescue people just as the storm arrived. All this in the surf, with breakers crashing all around. Farley got on the phone to Fisher Engineering headquarters, but by now there was too much money at stake and too many people wanted to believe he was mistaken. The operation continued. Meanwhile, someone else was having second thoughts, too. The Mimi's first mate, Frederick Fisher. Fisher, who was not privy to the discussions with Farley, had a horrible and very specific dream the night before the ship was to be taken off the beach. In his dream, Fisher saw the Mimi as a, quote, dead man's hotel, completely submerged, bodies drifting in and out of hatches. He also, according to Gibbs' account, saw the entire crew with seaweed on their heads and clouds covering their faces, the entire crew, that is, except for the captain and two of the men. When Fisher woke up, he was badly shaken. A nightmare is one thing, a highly specific nightmare that all but lists the names of those marked for death. That's rather another. After hearing his story, the second and third mates joined him in deserting the ship by making their way hand over hand while hanging from a cable connecting to the shore. When the word reached the sailors on the ship, they would have been right behind the officers, but Captain Westfall got out a revolver and threatened to shoot the next man who left. Given the choice between death right now and death maybe later, the men stayed aboard, although some others did slip away when the captain wasn't looking. Then it was time for the salvage operation to start. Heavy anchors had been placed out at sea and connected to the Mimi with thick cables. On board the ship, winches powered by steam donkeys now started reeling in the lines. They tightened, and inch by inch, the Mimi started responding, grinding sideways across the sand toward the open sea. Success was in hand. The ship was in deeper water. Any moment the sand would slide away and she would be freely floating. But the wind was already picking up, and the breakers were getting bigger and bigger. Suddenly the ship was free. She was afloat, for the first time in 4 months. And for the last time, too. The instant her keel was out of the sand, she started rolling in a particularly sinister way, with a looseness that caused onlooking mariners to catch their breath in horror. And then, with astonishing suddenness, the huge sailing ship was on her side, masts pointing shoreward, breakers crashing against her hull. Farley was ready. Against the growing wind and mounting breakers, his surfmen rowed to the scene, but the Mimi's rigging was everywhere he needed to be. Try as they did, the boat's crew could not get anywhere near the Mimi's crew. Remember, there were seas breaking over the wreck this entire time. The boat couldn't go anywhere unless all the oars could stay in the water to hold its position. Some of the spars were flailing around dangerously, and at one point an oncoming breaker stood the surf boat almost on its end, a whisker away from a disastrous pitch-pole wreck. If that had happened, it almost certainly would have added Farley and crew to the casualties list. The surfmen spent the next 24 hours trying to get to the ship, resting on the shore, trying again. Meanwhile, some of the bystanders on the shore were getting increasingly hostile, and Farley was worried about fights breaking out. Exhausted, hypothermic surfmen were staggering around and slurring their words, leading some people to assume they were drunk. The next morning, the seas were much calmer, and Farley and his crew managed to thread the boat into a 10-foot-wide open channel to the vertical deck of the mostly submerged ship. There they found just 3 survivors of the Mimi's crew, the captain and 2 of the men. Fisher also survived. As for the other 17, well, they ended up with seaweed on their heads and clouds on their faces drifting in and out of open hatches in a dead man's hotel at the bottom of the sea. Among the 4 survivors were the 2 men most responsible for the disaster, Captain Westfall and Captain Fisher, the head of the salvage firm. These 2, throughout the following inquiry into the causes of the wreck, displayed a jaw-dropping ungraciousness toward the guys who'd saved their lives. Both tried mightily to distract from their own responsibility for the disaster by trying to throw their rescuers under the bus. Farley and his men, they claimed, had been timid and lazy. Westfall went so far as to claim that the surf that had capsized his ship was, quote, no rougher than the surface of the Nehalem River, and that he couldn't imagine why the rescuers had made him wait so long for rescue. Fisher went in one better, testifying in the hearing that the water was, quote, quiet as a pond, and accusing his rescuers of having been drunk and attributing the delay in getting him off the wreck to inefficiency and cowardice. It's at least a little gratifying that the investigators weren't fooled by this performance. Quote, the charges of drunkenness were unfounded, the report concludes, and the major portion of the accusation seems to have been voiced by the head of the wrecking firm, who must realize there was criminal carelessness on his part or the bark would not have capsized. That would have been cold comfort, though, to the 17 sailors and 1 salvage crewman who died, and to their families. Well, that's it for our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are on offbeatoregon.com, where you'll also find full citations to the sources used in writing this story, along with more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by date of publication. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising or ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation anyway, may I suggest that you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, published by the History Press in 2012. You can order it from the store link on offbeatoregon.com if you'd like, but if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Don't be a stranger, especially don't be a stranger if you have a good idea for one of these columns in the future. Speaking of the future, our next show will be coming your way at around 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.